Chapter 2. Truth is strange, stranger than fiction. I think it, but write that in making my appearance before the public I should at once acquaint them with my titles and name. My card, as I leave it at the houses of the nobility, my friends, is as follows. Major Galileo Grady Gahagan, H. EEICS, Commanding Battalion of Irregular Horse, Ahmednagar. Seeing, I say, this simple visiting ticket, the world will avoid any of those awkward mistakes, as to my person, which have been so frequent of late. There has been no end to the blunders regarding this humble title of mine, and the confusion thereby created. When I published my volume of poems, for instance, the Morning Post newspaper remarked that the lyrics of the art, by Miss Gahagan, may be ranked among the sweetest florets of the present spring season. The Quarterly Review, commenting upon my observations on the Pons Asinorum Fortu, London, 1836, called me Dr. Gahagan, and so on. It was time to put an end to these mistakes, and I have taken the above simple remedy. I was urged to it by a very exalted personage. Dining in August last at the palace of the TLRA at Paris, the lovely young Duchess of Orleans, who, though she does not speak English, understands it as well as I do, said to me in the softest Teutonic, Lieber Herr Major, haben Sie denn mit Negerischen Jager Battalion gelassen? Erum denn? Said I, quite astonished at her RLHSS's question. The PSS then spoke of some trifle from my pen, which was simply signed Goliath Gahagan. There was, unluckily, a dead silence as H. R.R. H. put this question. Comment donc? Said H. M. Lois PHLP, looking gravely at Count Moll, Lecher Major A. Quid l'Armée, Nicolas donc Sir Major de Linde. H. M. and the PR. Menster pursued their conversation in a low tone, and left me, as may be imagined, in a dreadful state of confusion. I blushed and stuttered, and murmured out a few incoherent words to explain, but it would not do. I could not recover my equanimity during the course of the dinner, and while endeavoring to help an English duke, my neighbor, to pull at a Austerlitz, fairly sent 7 mushrooms and 3 large greasy krauts over his whiskers and shirt frill. Another laugh at my expense. H. M. Le Major, said the Q of the BLGNS, archly, vous n'aurez jamais votre brevet de colonel. Her M.Y.'s joke will be better understood when I state that his grace is the brother of a minister. I am not at liberty to violate the sanctity of private life by mentioning the names of the parties concerned in this little anecdote. I only wish to have it understood that I am a gentleman, and live at least in decent society. Verbum sat. But to be serious, I am obliged always to write the name of Goliath in full, to distinguish me from my brother, Gregory Gahagan, who was also a major in the King's service, and whom I killed in a duel, as the public most likely knows. Poor Greg. A very trivial dispute was the cause of our quarrel, which never would have originated, but for the similarity of our names. The circumstance was this. I had been lucky enough to render the Nawab of Lucknow some trifling service in the notorious affair of Chopras G. McGee, and His Highness sent down a gold toothpick case directed to Captain G. Gahagan, which I of course thought was for me. My brother madly claimed it. We fought, and the consequence was that in about 3 minutes he received a slash in the right side, cut 6, which effectually did his business. He was a good swordsman enough. I was the best in the universe. The most ridiculous part of the affair is that the toothpick case was his. After all, he had left it on the Nawab's table at tiffin. I can't conceive what madness prompted him to fight about such a paltry bauble. He had much better have yielded it at once, when he saw I was determined to have it. From this slight specimen of my adventures, the reader will perceive that my life has been one of no ordinary interest. And, in fact, I may say that I have led a more remarkable life than any man in the service. I have been at more pitched battles, led more forlorn hopes, had more success among the fair sex, drunk harder, read more, been a handsomer man than any officer now serving Her Majesty. When I first went to India in 1802, I was a rock hornet of 17, with blazing red hair, 6'4" in height, athletic at all kinds of exercises, owing money to my tailor, and everybody else who would trust me, possessing an Irish brogue, and my full pay of 120 L a year. I need not say that with all these advantages I did that which a number of clever fellows have done before me, I fell in love, and proposed to marry immediately. But how to overcome the difficulty? It is true that I loved Julia Jowler, loved her to madness, but her father intended her for a member of council at least, and not for a beggarly Irish ensign. It was, however, my fate to make the passage to India on board of the annual Snob East Indiaman, Captain Duffy, with this lovely creature, and my misfortune instantaneously, to fall in love with her. We were not out of the channel before I adored her, worshipped the deck which she trod upon, kissed a thousand times the cuddy chair on which she used to sit. The same madness fell on every man in the ship. The two mates fought about her at the Cape, the surgeon, a sober pious Scotchman, from disappointed affection, took so dreadfully to drinking as to threaten spontaneous combustion, and old Colonel Lillywhite, carrying his wife and seven daughters to Bengal, swore that he would have a divorce from Mrs. L, and made an attempt at suicide. The captain himself told me, with tears in his eyes, that he hated his hitherto adored Mrs. Duffy, although he had had 19 children by her. We used to call her the witch. There was magic in her beauty and in her voice. I was spellbound when I looked at her, and stark staring mad when she looked at me. Oh, lustrous black eyes! Oh, glossy night black ringlets! Oh, lips! Oh, dainty frocks of white muslin! Oh, tiny kid slippers! Though old and gouty, Gahagan sees you still. I recollect, off Ascension, she looked at me in her particular way one day at dinner, just as I happened to be blowing on a piece of scalding hot green fat. I was stupefied at once. I thrust the entire morsel, about half a pound, into my mouth. I made no attempt to swallow, or to masticate it, but left it there for many minutes, burning, burning. I had no skin to my palate for 7 weeks after, and lived on rice water during the rest of the voyage. The anecdote is trivial, but it shows the power of Julia Jowler over me. The writers of marine novels have so exhausted the subject of storms, shipwrecks, mutinies, engagements, seasickness, and so forth, that although I have experienced each of these in many varieties, I think it quite unnecessary to recount such trifling adventures. Suffice it to say, that during our 5 months' trajet, my mad passion for Julia daily increased. So did the captain's and the surgeon's. So did Colonel Lillywhite's. So did the doctor's, the mate's, that of most part of the passengers, and a considerable number of the crew. For myself, I swore ensign as I was I would win her for my wife. I vowed that I would make her glorious with my sword, that as soon as I had made a favorable impression on my commanding officer, which I did not doubt to create, I would lay open to him the state of my affections, and demand his daughter's hand. With such sentimental outpourings, did our voyage continue and conclude. We landed at the Sundarbans on a grilling hot day in December 1802, and then for the moment Julia and I separated. She was carried off to her papa's arms in a palanquin, surrounded by at least 40 hookabaters, whilst the poor cornet, attended but by two dandies and a solitary beastie by which unnatural name these blackamoors are called, made his way humbly to join the regiment at headquarters. The TH Regiment of Bengal Cavalry, then under the command of Lieut. Colonel Julius Jowler, C.B., was known throughout Asia and Europe by the proud title of the Bundelkhand Invincibles. So great was its character for bravery, so remarkable were its services in that delightful district of India. Major Sir George Gutch was next in command, and Tom Thrupp, as kind a fellow as ever ran a Maratha through the body, was second major. We were on the eve of that remarkable war which was speedily to spread throughout the whole of India, to call forth the valor of a Wellesley, and the indomitable gallantry of a Gahagan, which was illustrated by our victories at Ahmednagar, where I was the first over the barricade at the storming of the Peta, at Argam, where I slew with my own sword 23 matchlock men, and cut a dromedary in two, and by that terrible day of Assaye, where Wellesley would have been beaten, but for me alone. I headed 19 charges of cavalry, took, aided by only 4 men of my own troop, 17 field pieces, killing the scoundrelly French artillerymen. On that day I had 11 elephants shot under me, and carried away Sindhia's nose ring with a pistol ball. Wellesley is a duke and a marshal, I but a simple major of irregulars. Such is fortune and war. But my feelings carry me away from my narrative, which had better proceed with more order. On arriving, I say, at our barracks at Dum Dum, I for the first time put on the beautiful uniform of the Invincibles. A light blue swallow-tailed jacket with silver lace and wings, ornamented with about 3,000 sugar loaf buttons, rhubarb-colored leather inexpressibles, tights, and red morocco boots with silver spurs and tassels, set off to admiration the handsome persons of the officers of our corps. We wore powder in those days, and a regulation pigtail of 17 inches, a brass helmet surrounded by leopard skin, with a bearskin top and a horsetail feather, gave the head a fierce and chivalrous appearance, which is far more easily imagined than described. Attired in this magnificent costume, I first presented myself before Colonel Jowler. He was habited in a manner precisely similar, but not being more than 5 feet in height, and weighing at least 15 stone, the dress he wore did not become him quite so much as slimmer and taller men. Flanked by his tall majors, Thrupp and Gutch, he looked like a stumpy skittle ball between two attenuated skittles. The plump little colonel received me with vast cordiality, and I speedily became a prime favorite with himself and the other officers of the corps. Jowler was the most hospitable of men, and gratifying my appetite and my love together, I continually partook of his dinners, and feasted on the sweet presence of Julia. I can see now, what I would not, and could not perceive in those early days, that this Miss Jowler on whom I had lavished my first and warmest love, whom I had endowed with all perfection and purity, was no better than a little impudent flirt, who played with my feelings, because during the monotony of a sea voyage he had no other toy to play with, and who deserted others for me, and me for others, just as her whim or her interest might guide her. As he had not been 3 weeks at headquarters, when half the regiment was in love with her. Each and all of the candidates had some favor to boast of, or some encouraging hopes on which to build. It was the scene of the annual snob over again, only heightened in interest by a number of duels. The following list will give the reader a notion of some of them. 1. Cornet Gahagan. Dot Ensign Hicks, of the Sappers and Miners. Hicks received a ball in his jaw, and was half choked by a quantity of carroty whisker forced down his throat with the ball. 2. Captain McGillicuddy, BNI Cornet Gahagan. I was run through the body, but the sword passed between the ribs, and injured me very slightly. 3. Captain McGillicuddy, BNI Mr. Mulligatawny, BCS, Deputy Assistant Vice Subcontroller of the Baglewolla Indigo Grounds, Ramgoli Branch. McGillicuddy should have stuck to swords play, and he might have come off in his second duel as well as in his first. As it was, the civilian placed a ball and a part of Mac's gold repeater in his stomach. A remarkable circumstance attended this shot, an account of which I sent home to the Philosophical Transactions. The surgeon had extracted the ball, and was going off, thinking that all was well, when the gold repeater struck 13 in poor McGillicuddy's abdomen. I suppose that the works must have been disarranged in some way by the bullet, for the repeater was one of Barod's, never known to fail before, and the circumstance occurred at 7 o'clock. 1. I could continue, almost ad infinitum, an account of the wars which this Helen occasioned, But the above three specimens will, I should think, satisfy the peaceful reader. I delight not in scenes of blood, heaven knows, but I was compelled in the course of a few weeks, and for the sake of this one woman, to fight 9 duels myself, and I know that 4 times as many more took place concerning her. I forgot to say that Jowler's wife was a half-caste woman, who had been born and bred entirely in India, and whom the colonel had married from the house of her mother, a native. There were some singular rumors abroad regarding this latter lady's history. It was reported that she was the daughter of a native Raja, and had been carried off by a poor English subaltern in Lord Clive's time. The young man was killed very soon after, and left his child with its mother. The Black Prince forgave his daughter, and bequeathed to her a handsome sum of money. I suppose that it was on this account that Jowler married Mrs. J., a creature who had not, I do believe, a Christian name, or a single Christian quality. She was a hideous, bloated, yellow creature, with a beard, black teeth, and red eyes. She was fat, lying, ugly, and stingy. She hated, and was hated by all the world, and by her jolly husband as devoutly as by any other. She did not pass a month in the year with him, but spent most of her time with her native friends. I wonder how she could have given birth to so lovely a creature as her daughter. This woman was of course with the colonel when Julia arrived, and the spice of the devil in her daughter's composition was most carefully nourished and fed by her. If Julia had been a flirt before, she was a downright jilt now. She set the whole cantonment by the ears. She made wives jealous and husbands miserable. She caused all those duels of which I have discoursed already, and yet such was the fascination of the witch, that I still thought her an angel. I made court to the nasty mother in order to be near the daughter, and I listened untiringly to Jowler's interminable dull stories, because I was occupied all the time in watching the graceful movements of Miss Julia. But the trumpet of war was soon ringing in our ears. And on the battlefield Gahagan is a man. The Bundelkund Invincibles received orders to march, and Jowler, Hector-like, donned his helmet and prepared to part from his Andromache. And now arose his perplexity. What must be done with his daughter, his Julia? He knew his wife's peculiarities of living, and did not much care to trust his daughter to her keeping. But in vain he tried to find her an asylum among the respectable ladies of his regiment. Lady Gutch offered to receive her, but would have nothing to do with Mrs. Jowler, the surgeon's wife. Mrs. Sawbone would have neither mother nor daughter. There was no help for it. Julia and her mother must have a house together, and Jowler knew that his wife would fill it with her odious blackamoor friends. I could not, however, go forth satisfied to the campaign until I learned from Julia my fate. I watched 20 opportunities to see her alone, and wandered about the colonel's bungalow as an informer does about a public house, marking the incomings and the outgoings of the family, and longing to seize the moment when Miss Jowler, unbiased by her mother or her papa, might listen, perhaps, to my eloquence, and melt at the tale of my love. But it would not do. Old Jowler seemed to have taken all of a sudden to such a fit of domesticity that there was no finding him. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.